money changing hands town. So
did you fellas grow your own wheat here as well on the farm? Would you have a field of wheat?
Well,
or would you bother with your father getting toll like that?
No, we didn't really. The mill property was separate. There's the pond and the stream below that goes down to the river, and that was the mill property. There was no, just this house on it, and there wasn't a farm with it at first. But then father and his brother Fred, they bought all that land across there, which included the Cambridge house and all right over. There's a road over there now. It's called the Falconwood Road. No, I'm sorry. It's called the Belmont Road, but it divides our farm and the Falconwood, which was then the insane asylum, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so they bought all the land down to the river. It was 170 acres that they bought, including the house, the right house, or later the right house. They bought that. Well, then, of course, they couldn't finance it. And so they sold it again to somebody else. The name's slipped me now, but then they bought it back again, but not all of it. Yes, they bought it all back, and then they sold the house to the millers. 12 acres of land went, 12, 15, I think it was 12, went with the miller house. And they had a fox ranch in their woods there, too. So there was a lot of land then, but the farming, well, they didn't farm it. They rented it out mostly and that type of thing because they were too busy at other things.
What was going on at Falconwood when you were a young fellow? Was it still in operation as the insane asylum?
Oh, yes.
It was, eh?
Yeah. Yeah, my father and the doctor who ran Falconwood were very friendly. So we were invited over there. Oh, Christmas concerts and, you know, anything special that was going on, we were always invited over. And, of course, it was in the winter time. You just went across the fields with the horse and sleigh. The first time that I realized there wasn't a Santa Claus, I was over at Falconwood, and they had this big, not like a big assembly hall, you know, where all the patients went, and they had put on this concert, and Santa Claus came and all that. And I was sitting right at on the end of the aisle seat, as they say, and Santa Claus came up the aisle, and I was there, and I could see that he had a mask on, you know, and I realized then that there wasn't. I made them admit to me that there was no Santa Claus, but I never forgot that. That was, I'd only be, you know, oh, maybe 6 or 7 or something like that.
It's a shock, isn't it?
Yeah. But we used to be back and forth a lot, and we had worked machinery back and forth some, because they ran a big farm over there. A lot of patients that were just a little brick or two short of a load, you know, and they were in there and they wanted to work, and they worked on the farm there. And I, the time it burned over there, I never forget that. It was all brick buildings, this big building, and the doctor's residence was in the center on the second floor, and then there was two wings went out, one each way. And this night, I don't know what started the fire, but it started in it'd be the east wing, next one that was near Charlottetown, like point that right. It started there, and there was no water of any kind to fight a fire. But it was just started, and it was burning against the wind, and it was coming through. There was a narrow, it was like a separate building there, and then a narrow corridor built, maybe, you know, just 10 feet wide or so, came through, and then there was the center portion, the same on the other side. And this fire was burnt the fire building, and it was about halfway coming through this corridor to the center, and it couldn't stop it. It was just coming that way, and they brought one of the howitzers out from the down the old drill shed, which is gone now too in Charlottetown.
A howitzer gun.
A howitzer gun, yeah, and fired him. Because there was only this narrow corridor, you see, so they fired a shot or two in there and burst a hole in it to stop the fire. But it wasn't successful anyway. The whole thing burned down.
Not really.
Eventually.
Was there people died in that fire?
Well, they had lots of time to get people out. I don't know, because they had them everywhere after that, in buildings here and there. Unless it was right at the beginning where it might have been somebody, but mostly everybody was out. But it was in the winter time.
Well, what did Falconwood look like? It was a big building, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, it was a huge building, really. What I say, there was a building, a big square, kind of a rectangular brick building, mostly three stories high. And then there was this corridor built across, and then there was the center block where the auditorium was, and the doctor's residence was all in that.
Wow.
And then there was the same type of thing went out the other side.
Wow.
Oh, it was a big place.
Well, how many people would be there at one time? Would there be dozens or hundreds?
Oh, I wouldn't be prepared to say that, but there'd be a lot, more than dozens.
Yeah.
They had them divided into the men and the women. We used to, as a young person, we'd be over there, and the doctor, we'd visit back and forth. And I can remember him giving us a guide to take us through the wards. I wouldn't be a teenager, younger. And he'd warn us, now, when you're going through the women's ward, he called it the hair puller's ward, make sure they don't get close to you because they'll grab your hair.
Really? And did that ever happen?
Never did, no, but he was warning us anyway. It's a little narrow stairway going up from one floor to the next.
Were they behind bars, or what kind of...
Oh, yeah.
They were behind bars?
Oh, yeah, women. The windows were all barred, yeah.
Wow. my neighbor...
First, I guess, they seemed to think that the women made more noise than the men.
Yeah.
We had a fellow that... he was more in... He wasn't in Falconwood. They had another building they called the poorhouse, which was... People that, they were always poor, of course, but they were just, a little queer, as the old lady said. They're all queer but me and thee, and thee's a little queer.
And where was the poorhouse?
Well, it's where that other hospital where that is now.
The old infirmary.
Yeah.
Opposite the Civic Center.
No.
No?
Right.
In the same place?
Oh, yeah, in the same place. It was just across the yard, more or less. And it was called the poor house. I think the building is still there. I think they're using it.
Huh.
But people like this fellow's name was Charlie Singleton, and he could do, a lot of work, and he came over here. They let him come over here in the summer, and he'd be helping us around on the farm and this, that. And eventually he got that he'd come over here in the summer and stay over, and we had a little building that's gone now. But originally it was on the end of the original house that was here, a little kitchen. And when the year I was born, they did all the work on the house. But they moved this little kitchen and put it on to the end of this another building. Here was our garage and ice house. And that house, that little building, there was still a stove in it and that type of thing. But it became known eventually as Charlie's house. He's going to live in that in the summer, in Charlie's house. Well, I say, he was just a little soft, but he was a great fella.
And he'd work on the farm here?
Oh, yeah, help whatever you want done. I shouldn't tell this now. My mother used to keep tourists away bad. Oh, we're getting off the tracks.
Oh, no, this is great.
My mother used to keep tourists and put on dinner parties for old groups that used to come out from town to arrange and then have a dinner party here. So this day, this car drove in from, they weren't from the island, they were strangers from from away, as we say, and they asked for, I don't know, they called her Mrs. Andrew or whether the lady of the house and so on, and Charlie was the only one home, and he came out, and of course he was kind of his face was kind of crooked, and he was quite kind of a wild-looking fella in a way, and he said, "No, mother's not home now, but she'll be home in an hour or so." My mother never got over that.
Did they ever come back?
Yeah, they came back, and this is how we found out the story. Anyway.
Did you ever hear of a person by the name of Minnie McGee being over at Falconwood? This would be just the year before you were born. Okay, so let's...
That's what we came out here.
That's right.
Well, I'll start about... Is it turned on now?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, ice was cut on the pond here, you know, as long as there was a dam here, and that was 200 years or so ago. But in the early days, the ice was more or less cut by hand. There was a plow, which we called an ice plow, and we hauled it with a horse. And it was there was a beam on it about 4 feet long, made of two pieces of steel. And in between these two pieces, there was flat steel about 8 inches deep, just a flat piece of steel with it sharpened on the bottom front corner. And those were all along in this beam and bolted together. And then when you hooked up, there was handles on the back of it, just like an ordinary plow or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it had a gauge on it for the width. But to start with, you didn't use a gauge. You had to use a twine across to tell you where to go, because there was not the gauge then. Would be good for the next one. You dropped it in the cut you made, and mm-hmm. you had the next one to go by. But you dragged this back and forth, and it was these teeth were about a half inch thick, and about 6 inches deep. But there were 8 inches, at least 8 inches deep or long, that went into the ice. So you'd get lined up on your twine you had stretched across there and go carefully as you could across, and the plow would just more or less make a mark the first time. And then once you had your mark, then you took the string away and you could... So you had to go back and forth on that same cut about 4 times, and it would go right down as far as it could go, about 8 inches down into the ice. Well, then you did... use the gauge then. You put the gauge in that cut, and then you did the next one, and you'd probably do 5 or 6 cuts across the ice like that. Well, then the rest of it had to be done by hand, so you had, we'll say, 6 strips of ice there, and you had these hand saws. There's one hanging up there. They're a regular cross-cut saw, if you know what they are. Mm-hmm. A flat piece of And there's one hanging up there yet.
Yes.
Yeah. You take one hand, the referred crosscut saw was normally used in the woods for two people, but you take one handle off, and you had a cut at the end, you had a cut right through to back to your next cut, in other words. And then you marked off about 8 strips with 8 cakes, you see, about 18 inches, 2 feet in width, mm-hmm. and made another cut in, right in. And then you took your big crowbars, we had them with flat flange on the end that would go into this cut a little bit, and you barred that strip off, and it would float, and you had 8 cakes there. But then you had to take your handsaw and saw, we sawed about halfway through that cake, always down to the bottom and across the top, and about halfway of the cake that you sawed, and you sawed every one, and then you could take your crowbar and hit that at the top, and it would break, and pretty straight generally. And so it wasn't so much sawing, but that's the way you had to do for all the cakes. That's the way you got them loose. And then the men and with their horses and sleigh then, you always left along both sides of the pond a strip of maybe 15 feet wide, something, that, so they'd have a place to pull the ice out and put it on their sleighs. And it was nothing here to see. I've counted 40 teams of horses here lined up waiting for ice. And because we're loading from both sides, and there was only one fella with his team, but one or two fellas always helped him, and then he helped the next guy, and so on. It was always two or three people that were loading the sleigh, and they would load, and if it was a single horse, maybe 10 cakes or so on. But we had a fairly heavy team, and we used to haul. Oh, sometimes we'd haul 40. If it was a good haul, and get 40 cakes on the big sleigh that we had. It was a big wood sleigh and a proper frame on it to hold ice. And these cakes that then would weigh around 200 pounds. A cake of ice, of good ice, 20 by 20 by 20, will weigh about 200 pounds. So originally, the ice just went to everybody around that wanted ice came and hauled it.
Free?
Well, no, we had to charge something for it because there was no way of retrieving the money. But then we started supplying people in Charlottetown, like Billy Drake. I don't know, he had a big ice house where the polyclinic is now. Mm-hmm. And you went in that little street alongside their parking lot. There's a little narrow street goes in there.
Yeah.
You turned in that, and then to your left then, right where their parking lot is in the building, was all ice house. And so the fellas would... I delivered the ice in to him. I had to pay for the everything and the hauling too. And for eight cakes, a strange thing, 8 cakes was called a load. Now, that all started back when, if you can visualize what a wood sleigh looks like, mm-hmm. without a frame on it, and you can, it'll just about hold 8 cakes sitting on their flat there. And so as long as when I had my memory of dealing with ice, it was always hauled by the load, and the load was 8 cakes. And so, anyway, we eventually kind of got it changed over more to... But a load, I was still hauling ice into Billy Drake for... about 65 cents. A load.
A load?
Yeah, 8 cakes. I had to pay 5 cents a cake to the haulers to haul it in there. And I had to cut it and everything else and deliver it to Billy Drake, and he packed it. And he put it in his ice houses and then covered it in sawdust, and It was there, you know, till the next summer. Then he cut each block into four pieces, and he had small tongs, there's one hanging up there, that he take a cake and throw it over his shoulder and go up two flights of stairs or whatever and put it in your icebox.
I wonder how much he was getting for a block like that.
Well, I don't know how much he was getting, but he was getting more than I was.
Well, really, if you were paying 5 cents a cake to...
Yeah, I was paying 5 cents.
So there's 40 cents of the 65 right there.
Yeah, I was left with very little. But if I wanted to sell it, you know, he wouldn't pay any more. And it had to be good ice. If it wasn't, if there was, just water frozen into ice is blue mostly. And then you build up on top of that with snow ice. And Billy would say, there's not much blue on it. But anyway, that's the way it worked, and I delivered it in. And we had teams hauling here, too. We always had two, one team and one single, hauling ice for ourselves, hauling it into him and being paid that way. Well, yeah, you got eight cakes, eight times six, eight times ten is 80, eight times seven. 7 cents. I had very little left, you know, anyway.
It was hardly any profit margin at all.
No, not very much. But that 65 cent was in the 60s. I never got as high as 70 for the eight cakes. So, anyway, then...
That would have been, we're talking late 20s, 30s here, I guess.
Yeah, well, early 30s when I... But when we started selling it that way to Drake, and there was another chap, Gillespie Goche, who right the other side of where the railroad tracks were, and there's a building there now that runs in along the tracks. So, anyway, that used to be his Goche's ice house.
But is it the same building that's there?
No, it might be parts of it, but it's entirely different. But it was a good ice house in a way for him to load, because you went in on the Lapthorne Avenue above and the ice house was way below. Everything was downhill. It could slide the ice all in. Yeah. Whereas Drake, he had to build it up. And he had two, the way he did it, we used to hoist it up with a horse and a slide, some. We did that at home here and that. But he just had a bunch of men, and they each one would be... He built it up, two men on a cake with a pair of tongs, and they'd sit it up on the next tier. And then two men there would take it the next way, right up to the top tier. And he just kept his ice house coming like that, you know, right out. And then it all had to be, say, buried in sawdust.
It was a big burn?
Well, it was built properly for an ice house. They had to have a... You started in like an airspace, and then you sheathed it, left airspace, and then sheathed it, and kept the ice then about at least 6 inches away from that sheathing, and then that was all filled with sawdust down around it, and it was buried on top with sawdust. And it'd keep there all summer. Quite often you'd have ice left over in the fall, you know, the next year.
How often could you actually cut the ice on the pond? How many times a year could you do that?
Oh, rarely would you get into the second cut, but yes, we sometimes would cut. But second ice is never as good. It's never as thick. Excuse me. It's never as thick to begin with, and it won't keep the same. It's full of little air bubbles. So, but we'd cut starting down at the dam there, and we'd cut up within a reasonable distance of the... Well, there was a bridge across there then, and then come down, and if we didn't have enough... We sometimes cut on the other side of the road, and but that was our pond, too, and still is. But Herb Love, who lived in the big right house, the old right house, he used to come down and ask permission to cut ice there sometimes, and it was a relative of his at a nice house in the edge of town. But we'd go up there and cut if we didn't have enough here. We'd cut second ice. And I remember one time we were on the second ice and we're just across over here about the middle. And the ice wasn't very thick. It was thin, only about 8 inches thick, I suppose. I know I had to put, I'll tell you about that, I had to put things under the saw, under the slay part of it, so the saw wouldn't cut right through. And taking a load of this ice into Billy Drake, and he had been in hospital and had a heart attack, and I didn't. I said, "Billy, you shouldn't be out here." You know, he was out there on the slide giving the ice a push to start it off down, and then the men would get hold of it. And I said, "You shouldn't be out this. You're only out of the hospital." And, "Oh," he says, "there's nothing to those little watch fobs." He says, "Give it a push." But anyway, he wanted a 200-pound block of ice, but if he couldn't get it, he'd take the smaller one.
And he was only calling them watch fobs.
Watch fobs, yeah.
He sounds like he was a real character. Did he have a brother who was a meat man? Was there a fellow in town called Drake the Meat Man? Or was it the same guy, maybe?
No, I don't think.
No, okay.
I don't know, anyway. Yeah. So anyway, that was the way it was cut, and everybody came and got ice, and if you know all the neighbors, and they all had to have ice to keep the milk cool and that type of thing, and they used it in their own ice boxes. There was no fridges. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you got paid and sometimes you didn't, but never worried much about it. And but anyway, after, I was a teenager, and I went to Prince of Wales College for 3 years, and I graduated in 1931. There's a reunion of PWC this weekend, by the way.
This is really?
I'm going to it.
Wow.
Anyway.
That would be the old PWC you went
to. The old PWC, yeah, burned shortly after that. And yeah, I went for 3 years there. That's all you could go at that time.
Yeah, so that would be your high school equivalent and then some.
Yeah, and a year extra.
And a year extra.
They called it first year university. So I went those 3 years, and that was 31. And so I took teacher training there, but I never taught. I came home and to work on the farm and help with the foxes and so on. So where was I now? Oh yeah, about the ice. So this business of cutting ice by hand, you know, I realized it was pretty laborious, and the men, of course, were crying for work. They'd walk out from Charlottetown and be here at 8 o'clock in the morning, and they used one of those cross-cut saws and whatever bars and so on, and they worked till 5 o'clock in the evening, and if they brought their own lunch with them, we gave them $1.25 a day. And if they didn't, we gave them their lunch, it was $1. But that was the going wage then. And there was no unemployment, there was no other means of getting any money. They had to, so they were crying for work. But even at that, with my low margin of profit, I wasn't making much money. So I decided I'd try to build a mechanical ice cutter. And that's it right behind you there. I'll tell you about it. And so, of course, like the same thing like it is today, I did build it and it worked good and so on, but I immediately replaced about 7 or 8 men that didn't have work. But it was much quicker and so on. There's lots of headaches with it, too. And so we cut the ice with this but the operation of pulling it out of the water and loading the sleighs and all that was the same. It was just the cutting was different for a few years. And then I bought this escalator that's over here. and I bought it from Drake. I didn't build that. I built the cutter. But Billy had built that, and was one time he was getting ice somewhere else, and so he wasn't using it. And it was a great rig. You could put it to, well, it's about, 15 feet long, mm-hmm. and it's quite heavy. It's similar to a nice hay escalator, and we ran it with a stationary engine. There was legs on one end of it, and the other end dropped into the water and rested on the bottom. And the other end was up, and legs held it up. And there was another short chute on the end of it to run from the end of the escalator onto a sleigh or to a truck. So, we had an old Woodpecker 5-horsepower stationary engine here, as long as I can remember. So we set it on the ice down below, and we put a little belt up onto the pulley that was there, and that's what made it turn. In later years, when I got this tractor that we're sitting, I used it from the power takeoff and put a shaft out. It was much simpler because you didn't have to worry about the belt getting out of line and all that, but it got water on it and it would freeze and the belt slip and so on. So we used that, and it's somewhat the same idea. You cut your cuts crossways on the ice, and only it was much easier with it. The first cut was always get it straight if you could, but you didn't need any markers. You just put a string along and went by that. And then the next one, it has guides on it too, and you drop the guides into that last cut, and so you just went once. You didn't have to go back and forth. You just made the one cut across.
All right, sir.
Yeah. Well, this is the machine that I built back in right after university, PWC, and I came back and so decided that this handwork was too much work. And so I got the idea from the old Family Herald one time. They used to put plans for different things. So I saw some, it wasn't like this, but it gave me the idea. So this is, to start with then, it was a Model T engine. This is now upgraded to a Model A, but it was a Model T engine. And this, it's on runners.
Yeah.
Where's that then?
Runners.
Those are the guides there for your next cut, and there's two of them, so to keep you straight. And it was Model T, and the Model T engines, the rear axle was just a straight piece of steel, and the bearings where the wheels were, all we did was cut the axles off and slide the bearings in to the width we wanted. There's some of the old bearings there, by the way.
Yes, roller bearings.
Roller bearings, but you could just slide them in. You didn't have to do anything but just slide them in and put them where you wanted them. So we worked it that way. We had little short axles, and we built this sleigh, which went underneath, hardwood, and for runners on it, there's just ordinary pipe. Much better with a round runner than a flat one.
Mm-hmm.
It'll work a lot better. And then this part where the saw is, that's hinged there. And this lever, undo that hook.
Yeah, there's a lever right on top of everything.
Yeah, the saw will drop down into the ice, and it rides on the back end of these runners here. They're tapered a little like so.
Huh.
And it just slides along on the ice, and it'll cut. It won't go all the way down. It'll cut to about there.
Well, really,
about 10 inches.
Quite remarkable. And the whole thing is probably about 9 or 10 feet long, I'd say.
Yeah.
And the saw blade looks to be about 3 foot in diameter.
Well, perhaps a little less than three, but 32 inch maybe. But anyway, it's driven then off the rear end. I sent to England for these sprockets and chains. And there's the big ones here and the smaller ones out there on your saw axle.
And that would give you more speed with the with the blade.
That's right. So what you did then, once you got the motor going, of course, and the original old Model T engine had, if you're not familiar, they had a wooden coil for each cylinder. There was no distributor, and there was a little wooden box with the points on the top of it, and there was one for each four cylinders. And they were more or less open. They were in a box, and you took the cover off, and if wasn't working right, it's like you had to touch the points up or something, like you still do. But you had to crank it. There was no starter on them. And that became, pretty hard in a cold morning, and that to get it going. So anyway, we suffered along with it for a number of years. But the first time I took it down on the ice, to begin with, it made quite a noise. There was no muffler on her. we later put one on, but there wasn't one on. And when you dropped the saw down in the ice, there was a streak of sawdust. Snow went about 20 feet in the air up from the blade.
A rooster tail.
Yeah, but it was quite a rig, and it, of course, scared all the horses to death. But I started in then, and I made about 5 cuts back and forth across the ice, which only took a few minutes because he could just go over. And I walked backwards in front of it. I walked backwards. This is the way it pulled.
Right.
All the handles were ready is to steady it. If the ice was nice and smooth and like a hockey rink, it would run away with itself. The saw pulled it. But if it was really good traveling on the ice for the runners, you had to hold it back and guide it so the saw wouldn't run up under the ice. So to come across and then swing it around and drop your gauges in and go back the other way. So you did that for 5 cuts, or say. And then the same idea, you had to... I backed it out then across these 5 cuts. But I didn't. You didn't want to get water in any of the cuts, or they'd freeze up right away. So I'd back it out to about 2 inches from the water and drop the saw in, and of course it would come down. And you cut crossways then. And you could, cut... If you had 5 cuts this way and you do about 20... cuts crossways, you had a lot of ice.
Wow.
And then you still had to saw the rest of the way on that end one. You had to, because it wasn't cut all the way down, you sawed that back here 5 cuts right through with that one of those hand saws, but you only had about 2 or 3 or so inches to cut. And you did the same in about 10 cuts this way. And then as soon as that was cut, it was practically floating. You just took a bar and just touched them, and they were floating. They were almost cut through within 2 or 3 inches of the bottom. And so once you had these cuts done, and generally before you finished the cutting this one all the way, you went out and made sure you didn't fall in. you loosened up all the ice.
What a slick machine.
Oh, it was quite a machine, I'll tell you. There were other ones. They had a machine in town there where the... Where the co-op store is, in one on Queen Street.
Yeah, down at Royalty Mall.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was an ice pond there one time, I cut ice in there with this machine.
Did you really?
Yeah. There was somebody after.
Well, there's a Pond Street right around there.
Yeah, well, that's why it's called Pond Street. There was a pond there. And it was drained and into the storm sewer and filled in, and that's where the mall was built.
And so you used to go around with this and cut ice
elsewhere?
Well,
not normally, no.
No.
But this fella had a machine, and it was just a smaller rig that ran with a stationary engine, and he pulled it by hand, and it broke down on him, and he had contracts that he was supposed. So I went in for 2 or 3 days after I was finished here and cut ice in there. And
where did the Model T original engine come from? Was that from a car you fellas had?
Yeah, it was one of our own. I learned to drive on a Model T Ford, and it was the same one. I dismantled it and built this rig out of it.
Did you really?
Yeah.
What year was the Model T? Was it right-hand drive? Was it one of the old ones that you drove on the wrong, where the wheel was on the wrong side?
I think so, yeah, because, I believe you're right now. I never thought about that part of it, but I believe the wheel was on the right-hand side.
Yeah. You were born in 13, so you would have learned to drive on the proper side of the road, because we changed in 24, I think. We went over to the side we drive on now.
Yeah, well, it was.
So that would be after
you
were...
Yeah, I remember the time they changed over, so it would be then.
Yeah.
It had the three little pedals on the floor that you... One was the brake, and one was the forward and reverse, and the center one... No, forward, low gear and high gear, and the center one was reverse. And you had three pedals on the floor. That's what I learned to drive on when I was about 12 or 13.
You're kidding. Is that right?
Yeah, we had one. Well, right after that, we had one at the end of the war, and we always had a big Cadillac, a huge, big, open Cadillac. That's another story. Better finish with this.
All right.
So anyway, this rig worked pretty well. It was the old Model T, but we were cutting second ice, and we're about halfway up the pond there on the second ice. And I cut too much ahead, without breaking it up. And anyway, when I ran the machine, I cut the length crossways, and then when I backed the machine out to do the cross-cutting, I just got out there and went to drop the saw, and the whole thing broke loose. And because the ice was on, the saw would have been going right through, so I put pieces under the end of the sleigh part there to keep it up. And I was still only leaving about an inch of ice, see? And when it got the weight on it, it all broke loose. And I couldn't do anything but let her go and get off onto solid ice, and the whole thing disappeared under, and I think it kept going afterwards for about 5 minutes. There was still bubbles coming up there for a long while after it disappeared.
Underwater.
Underwater, yeah, and the bubbles were coming up.
That's something.
So anyway, that ended the cutting for that year. We were about done anyway.
So you'd have to haul it up. You'd have to haul it up in the wintertime, I guess.
We had a hell of a time to get it out. I'd never seen the bottom of the pond, and I didn't know what was down there. But we found out when we started trying to... I thought, well, we'll get the tractor. I had this tractor then. We got the long cable, hay cable, and a big hook. We knew where it dropped, and the solid ice was right alongside. So we got a hook on it and thought, well, we'll just start going and drag her out the other side. But there's just one mass of stumps in the bottom of that pond. When they built the dam over 200 years ago, it was all wooded there, and all they did was cut the trees off. About some of them were this high, some of them this high, and so on. And so we couldn't drag it. We had to... We got another hook on it, and we got a a whole lot of people mainly, when we could move it a little piece, we'd strike a stump, and then we'd get and lift it up and try to, and then the tractor would go on and get it over the stump. But by the time we got it out by doing that, and by that time it was all smashed to hell. The saw wasn't smashed, these chains and sprockets were smashed, and everything, the radiator was broken off it, and the gas tank, and there wasn't that much of it. So I decided I had to send back to England to get the same, the sprockets and the chains again. And I went to get a Model A. That'd make it easier because it'll have a starter on it and so on. So that's with this one. I bought this one down all the way down towards Pownall there. Fella had a Model A, and I went down and I towed it home and got the motor out of it, and we could use the same frame. They were the same width, so we didn't have to do anything there in the sleigh, that part of it. And then the main problem was joining it up here, because the universal joint down here on the Model T was, both sides were square as it went together, mm-hmm. and the Model A is a spleen on one side. So with a lot of filing and frigging around, I got the two of them put together.
But that must have been in the 1950s, because you said you had that tractor. And didn't you say that tractor was 1950?
Oh, yeah, I did. No, it couldn't have been that.
Must have been a different tractor.
It was the old tractor we had before that. It was an International, too, with the spiked wheels. And
you're kidding, is that right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's...
How long did the ice cutting last? Right up into the 50s?
Yeah, it... in the 50s, around 1950, we got a fridge, for instance. And everybody was starting to get fridges then. So the ice business, but that was after the war. We stopped pretty well when I went overseas for 5 years, and from 1940, went overseas in 40. And when I came back, I took a job with tax office for about 3 years, and I got fed up with that. I worked the inside, so I came back to farm. Hmm. And so during that, we started in again then to cut ice, but at the same time the fridges were coming in, and I sold very little to Drake anymore because people were buying fridges. But I built an ice house down below the dam, which we'll probably see later on. And we had built a mill down there, a new mill. I'd torn the other mill down and built a new one. And we used the mill and built a... It was open, no top on it. We used poles out of the woods and so on, and made an ice house. And that's when I was selling mostly to fishermen. I'd store the ice, and they were hauling lobsters, and they'd come to here, and they could drive down below, and we'd load their truck, cover the lobsters with ice, and that. And there were still tourists. We used to bring it up here and put it in one of our small buildings there, and, you know, just a cake or two at a time, and one of the kids was dispensing it. We'd cut it 2 and 4 blocks, and they'd sell it. We had signs out at the gate and around the road, and people would come and buy it. And that was after the war, in the early 50s, while the kids were... first child was born in 1946, and 49 and 53, and 51 and 53, so that's all they were... getting old enough to disperse the ice if there was no one around. So anyway, we rebuilt the thing and used the Model A engine, which is this one here now. And I have another one there that I was using for spare parts when I need it. Never used very many of them, but I bought it for that reason. And it has a, it had a, that's where the battery sat there, and it has a starter on it.
Well, how did you get so smart around engines and machinery? Because this isn't something that you just did it on a whim.
I'm probably taking more credit. I didn't do it all alone. I mean, I did it in the, I had the idea of what I wanted to do, and I did the most of it. But there's a fellow that lived just up across the fields here, which we had a farmer's house just up there. It's still there, one of those smaller houses up there. And there was a Harold Clemens who lived in the first house that's up here, going up the hill.
Yeah.
First house. But that house wasn't there then, but he had a forge anyway. With, you know, he could heat metal, and he had an engine for. So he helped me, shaping all this stuff, bending and doing all that type of thing. He was able to do it. I worked with him, and we did it in the forge.
Yeah.
Built a lot of it there, and then brought it down here and put it together. So, there's a lot of, there is a lot of mechanical and.
And it's unique, I think. Is there another one on the island?
No, I don't think one like this, no.
Did you ever see anybody or ever hear of anybody else doing this from something they saw in a Family Herald?
There's been, people up west and that have had a rig for cutting with an engine, but most of them use stationary engine. Mm-hmm.
I've even seen a picture of one of those, and it
had so many horses with this snow dust, I suppose you'd call it, going up there, that I put a cover over the saw so that it wouldn't shoot up and stop it about, just off the ground a piece. And that was a big, big improvement as far as the horses were concerned. But, it was a great rig, and of course, the problem with that, always used to, could never get the radiator. The radiator was always leaking a little and things like that. And so I nearly always, unless it was a really mild night, I nearly always hook a horse onto it and haul it up in here, into the barn here, because it could get it started easier in the morning and put hot water in it and things like that.
Yeah. I guess there wasn't antifreeze in the early days, was there?
No, I suppose it was, but I don't know, I guess there would be then. I know in one of our cars that I was driving, we used to use kerosene in it.
As your antifreeze?
As antifreeze, yeah. Huh. And Then I remember there was a water pump was on the side of it here, and it had leather and a rubber hose on both sides, and it could never get the water out of the pump. There'd always be a little water. The kerosene wouldn't push it up. And so nearly every morning, this was back when I was going to Prince of Wales, and when we could, we took a car. But the water pump would always be frozen up, so you'd come from the house to get the car going. You took the hot water, kettle of hot water with you, and poured it on the pump to loosen it up before, or to twist the rubber off.
Well, what was the story on the Cadillac? You said that you fellas always had a Cadillac. That must have been right around the end of the First War.
Yeah. Well, is there anything else we want to talk about here? I'll tell you about that, all right. But as far as this is concerned, we used this as long as had ice to cut. We used this and the escalator. Well, we don't need to go over there. You know what an escalator is like. And anyway, the escalator that I got. I guess I told you about that, but I guess we didn't. We weren't. It's about 15, 20, nearly 20 feet long, 15 anyway, and it's quite heavy. It's similar to a hay escalator, But it's very heavy, built out of heavy planking. And there's metal strips across, there's the double chain, the same as on any escalator, and pieces across, and they're all, it's all metal, and they would, you'd float the ice, put the thing in place first, and there was the top end of it had two legs which held it up above, about 4 or 5 feet off the ice, and there was a short slide from it to either a sleigh or a truck. And it ran with a, at first with a stationary engine, and in later years with the off the power takeoff of a tractor. But when we talked about cutting the ice, well, then in order to get the ice to this escalator, you had to cut a sluice in, so you could float the ice right in until the escalator could pick it up, and. That's really about it. You, depending on where you were working, you, sometimes that sluice was that you cut was fairly long, yeah, because you didn't want to be moving this thing very often. But we we had to move it a good many times. We were going up the pond.
Yeah.
And well, that's the way it worked. You just used it instead of saved all the trouble of hauling these big blocks out of the water. It was a heavy work and quite a trick to pull a 200-pound cake out. You had to know how to do it, you know, with the tongs, and you had to tip it on edge and get the edge up, sort of, and then grab it, and it kind of tipped out. And then, as I said before, I think it was always some when we were hauling with horses, there'd be more than one person to help load. And well, just to go back to that a minute, I'd forgotten really what I did say, but you could make 4 trips with horses and sleigh, 4 trips to town in a day, and you got 5 cents a cake. So if you had 40 cakes on, 5 times 20,
five times 40 is $2.
$2 for a trip. And if you could make 4 trips, you know, you're talking $8 a day, which is pretty good. And but that's the way it worked. But if you're only hauling 30 cakes, which most of them did, some of them had big rigs, big bobsleds and so on, could take a lot of ice. But it was good money then for hauling back then. And if you could make your 4 trips, you had to be nimble to do that and no waste any time. And so, the big thing was you went out through our, what we call the mill road there. That's where everything went out that way. And then you had to go up that hill. The hill was, before it got down, was pretty steep there. It was quite a drag getting, but you didn't. It was a high hill and a low hill. And you always went out and went up on the high hill, which wasn't as steep. You were up sort of 10 feet to start with, you know. So, but that's the way it worked. And then, of course, there was all the pitches to deal with on the cemetery hill. There were just this type of thing all the way.
Undulating.
Yeah. So that pretty well, as far as the... in the spring of the year, the people that hadn't got ice and hadn't paid me, after I was closed down here, I'd gear up the horse and sleigh and go around and call on them and try and get my money back, you know. And mostly I did. They were all pretty good if they had it. A lot of them didn't have it, you know.
Yeah.
So then what else? Now that's about the escalator, the way it... Wow. As I said before, I've got as many as 40 teams of horses here waiting for ice. Okay. And if there's too many, that's what slow the fellow down that's hauling to town, you know. Yeah. He couldn't get in to get his load. And
yeah, of course.
All right, well, what else was it? Oh, you want to talk about the Cadillac car?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, my first recollection, sort of the Cadillac car, It was a big, it was the, well, I was always told it was the first car on the island. Now, Red Stearns, who was a sort of a self-named car dealer way back then, he used to bring in only one or two or so cars, three cars. And this car he brought in, and he was driving it for a bit himself. This is, what do they call them now, dealer's car or something. But anyway, it was a new car. And it was a tremendous car. I don't know how long it would be, but it seems to me it was, of course, 20 feet is not that long. It was a big, long car. There was, the wheels on it were, 2.5 feet, I'd say, high, the wheels. And when you got in the front seat, that wheel, yeah, it was on the right turn too. The gear shift was an open gear shift. You could, it's like some of the old tractors. You could see what gear you were putting it in, you know. And the emergency brake was out on the running board. I can remember that brake. And it was a big, long brake, and the running boards, of course, went the full length of the car. And this big, long lever, you reached ahead and pulled it, and it came back, at least 3 feet, you know, when at the top, when putting on the emergency brake. And the headlights were... They set out, one each side of the motor part, and they were not all filled in like they are now. It was a separate unit, and it'd be about a foot across, like so, a great big light there, one each side. And the dash lights then were, about the size of ordinary lights. It'd be 5 inches or so. They were one on each side of the dash. And of course, it was an open car. The hood would go down, and you could put it up and when it rained. And there were sides that went on it, canvas sides that you could put in place. But mostly we drove it when we could with the hood down, and the hood stood out the back. There was the front seat and the back seat, and on the back of the front seat, there were two little seats that tipped down, that you could put the two extra people there in the back. And then the sticking out the hood then all went out another 3 or 4 feet out the back, just folded back down there. You see the odd one yet, that's the way they got to fold down there. But it made it an awful long car. And my first recollection, really, of it, was that the war had ended, First World War. And the men were up back of the mill there, as we call it, on the hill in that field, pulling turnips. So Mother got the word, and she sent me off to tell the men the war was over. So they all rushed down, and everybody piled into this big Cadillac car and took off to Charlottetown. And the horn on it was not a horn like there is now. It was like a bugle, and a knob that stuck up the top, and you pushed that down, and it went, hurrah, hurrah. That was the sound it made. And you pushed this lever down.
Just hang on.